Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 26, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows a close-up of a section of the new border wall with Mexico. It's the vertical steel sort of rust-colored rectangular pieces that are have just a little space between them. And behind the wall, we have five brown faces. There's a man, two men, a woman, a teenage girl, and looks like a young boy or girl, with concerned looks on their faces looking through the wall. The headline is Asylum Denied. Will Biden's New Border Policy Stem the Tide? That is our first main story. We'll start with that. New border rules prevent a surge for now. What happened? The Biden administration said it was encouraged this week after new asylum rules instituted after the lifting of Title 42 did not result in an expected surge of migrants at the border. Last week, President Biden sent 1,500 troops to the border and warned things would get chaotic after the end of the COVID-related public health order, which for 3 years allowed border agents to summarily expel migrants. But after more than 10,000 migrants a day sought to cross the border just before Title 42 ended, much stricter asylum rules adopted by the administration under a restored policy called Title 8, including a five-year entry ban on migrants who try to enter illegally, cut the influx by half, with fewer than 5,000 migrant encounters a day. The five-year ban in particular has opened migrants' eyes, said Enrique Lucero, Director of Migrants Affairs in the Mexican border city of Tijuana. Reeling under a record number of border crossings this year, the Biden administration has expanded pathways for legal migration while tightening the standards for asylum claims. Border officials have created a cell phone app where 1,000 asylum seekers a day can make appointments at official ports of entry. The administration has also announced plans for regional offices in Guatemala, Colombia, and other countries where migrants can apply for refuge. Most asylum seekers must now show they sought protection in Mexico or another country first, while those caught crossing illegally are subject to deportation and a five-year ban on re-entering. Such tougher consequences appear to be working for now, said Department of Homeland Security official Blas Nunez Neto, though he warned, this is a continuously evolving situation. What the editorial said. Biden's new immigration measures are welcome and long overdue, said Bloomberg. If enforced, they stand to ease the border crush and undermine the business model for smugglers. The president's stricter policies dismay progressives, but they reflect political reality. With cities such as New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., facing strains on resources and services because of an influx of migrants bused there by Republican governors, further dysfunction risks souring the wider public on immigration of all kinds. Cities under siege and overwhelmed border agents and immigration judges is what failure looks like, said the Wall Street Journal. Biden campaigned against Trump policies he maligned as cruel, and once in office, he ended deterrents such as the Remain in Mexico policy, signaling that the border was essentially open. The ensuing catastrophe has carried a steep human cost and has dimmed the odds of drafting sensible legislation that would allow the legal immigration we need. Even pro-immigration Republicans won't discuss immigration reform until the border is all but closed. what the columnist said. This might be an inflection point in Biden's presidency, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. His party's progressive vanguard disdains policies designed to stem immigration, and American voters know it. A recent poll found that 57% of Americans disapprove of Biden's border policies, a serious threat to his reelection. If you're nervous about a Trump restoration in 2024, nothing will endanger democracy more than images of migrants flooding into the U.S. as the administration flails. If immigration is going to take center stage in the next election, Americans need to understand the true scope of the ongoing tragedy, said Leon Krauts in the Washington Post. The consequences of asylum deterrence are on full, sordid display in Matamoros, a Mexican border city where forgotten people desperate for work and safety in the U.S. fester in squalid camps, choked with misery and despair. Children dressed in rags and ridden with infections live among garbage, excrement, violence, and disease. Providing safety and dignity to these human beings is a moral imperative. The current lull could be the calm before another storm, said Miriam Jordan in the New York Times. The new asylum restrictions face legal challenges and will not stop the widespread political instability, war, gang violence, and economic ruin driving Central and South American migrants to our border, a global exodus of desperate, dispossessed people seeking better lives in developed nations is underway. And for those in the Western Hemisphere, almost all roads lead to one country, the United States. Controversy of the week. Trump. How should the media cover a demagogue? The madness is back, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times, and the 2024 election season is going to be an even stranger and scarier ride than 2020 and 2016. That was the unmistakable takeaway from CNN's town hall interview with Donald Trump last week, in which the former president made it clear he's as shameless, unhinged, and deceitful as ever. The 2020 election was rigged and stolen, Trump still insisted. January 6, 2021 was a beautiful day, so beautiful he's inclined to pardon most of the Capitol rioters. The writer E. Jean Carroll, whom a jury last week determined Trump sexually abused in the mid-1990s and later slandered, is a whack job Trump can't remember meeting. On and on Trump went, denying incontrovertible facts, portraying himself as both a victim and the only man who can save America. CNN was right to let viewers see and hear the existential menace to American democracy, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. He's far and away the front runner for the Republican nomination. But it was indefensible of the network to let the local Republican organization pack the hall with Trump's cult-like fans who cheered Trump's toxic slurry of lies and hooted with glee when Trump directed his favorite misogynistic epithet, nasty, at interviewer Caitlin Collins for challenging his lies. CNN has learned nothing about how to cover this dangerous and malevolent demagogue without playing into his hands. Don't blame CNN, said Josh Barrow and joshbarrow.com. Liberal critics with control freak instincts squirmed because some members of the crowd cheered Trump's antics. But didn't we see in 2020 and the 2022 midterms that MAGA extremism is off-putting to a majority of general election voters? The town hall may have elated Trump's hardcore supporters, said Mark A. Thiessen in the Washington Post. But it was a three-alarm dumpster fire for the GOP. Trump's belligerent ranting no doubt sounded like fingernails on a chalkboard to the centrist swing voters who decide national elections, and served as a reminder of why they elected Joe Biden. You don't serve democracy by normalizing authoritarians who seek to end it, said Amanda Carpenter in The Bulwark. In its cynical pursuit of ratings, CNN gifted its airwaves to a man who incited a mob to overturn the voters' will, who has glorified political violence against his opponents, who laughs off sexual assault, and who now promises to be his supporters' retribution against everyone they hate and resent. Providing a stage for a known liar to tell his lies is not journalism, said Megan Garber in The Atlantic. The town hall was a costly act of concession to someone who despises press freedom and truth as much as he despises free elections. Collins asked the wrong questions, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Instead of hammering Trump for his personal scandals, election lies, and so forth, which most Republican voters dismiss, future interviewers and opponents should attack him from a conservative perspective. Ask him why Mexico never paid for the wall that Trump never finished, or why his pledge to end American carnage preceded a surge in violent crime. Why do so many of his own former top aides say that he's a loser who's unfit for office? If the media and Trump's opponents attack him the same way they did in 2016, the results may be just as disastrous. So, good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for holy relics after a Taylor Swift fan used an e-commerce site to advertise a pair of contact lenses she wore while viewing Swift's ongoing sold-out Eras tour. The contacts are in excellent condition, the seller says, and yours for only $10,000. It was a good week for normalcy, with reports of a boom in smile training seminars across Japan as citizens acclimate to the end of that country's strict face masking rules. I'm reminded how important smiles can be, said attendee Akiko Takazawa, 79. And it was a good week for Olivias, who had the most popular name for girls born in 2022, according to the Social Security Administration. Emma and Charlotte were second and third most popular. The three most popular boys' names were Liam, Noah, and Oliver. But it was a bad week for body wash, with a new Virginia Tech University studies finding that certain flowery, fruity soaps make humans more attractive to mosquitoes. These scents make us smell like a flower and a person at the same time, a researcher said. It was a bad week for Mike Lindell, the MyPillow CEO and ardent Trump supporter, who said that he has so far spent $40 million on his chaotic efforts to prove that the not-stolen 2020 election was in fact stolen. We need help, Lindell said. And it was a bad week for altruism after Paraguayan politician Arturo Mendez defended the practice of giving money, beer, and food to indigenous people in exchange for their votes because it would be heartless not to. Here's a short and other news piece. NCGOP overrides veto to limit abortion. The North Carolina State Legislature's Republican supermajority voted this week to override Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's veto of a 12-week abortion ban. North Carolina's law, which goes into effect on July 1st, contrasts with the complete bans and heartbeat bills, which effectively bar the vast majority of abortions passed in other states over the past year. The 12-week timeline, with exceptions for the life of the mother, rape and incest, and lethal fetal anomalies, would allow about 90% of current abortions. Overriding the veto became possible when State Representative Tricia Cotham switched from the Democrats to the GOP last month, giving Republicans a supermajority. Cotham, for years an outspoken supporter of abortion rights, voted for the new limits. The title of the briefing this week is The Casino on the Couch. The legalization of sports betting is generating billions in revenue and ruining lots of lives. How much is being bet? A staggering amount. Last year, Americans placed $93.7 billion in game bets, according to the trade publication Sports Handle. In the first 3 months of 2023, nearly $30 billion was bet, a rate of $120 billion a year. That would surpass the $108 billion Americans spent on lotteries last year and marks a massive increase from the $21.5 billion legally bet on sports in 2020. Until 2018, sports betting was banned everywhere in the U.S. except Nevada casinos. But 5 years ago this month, the Supreme Court struck down a federal ban allowing states to legalize sports betting. The result was the biggest expansion of legal gambling in U.S. history. 33 states now have legal sports betting, and four more soon will, while another eight have pending legislation or voter referendums. In 24 states with legal online gambling, placing a bet is as simple as opening a smartphone app. It puts a casino at the tip of everybody's hand, said Mark Edelman, an expert in sports gambling law at Baruch College. Do pro sports leagues support this? For a century, major sports leagues vehemently opposed legal gambling, casting it as a threat to the sport's integrity. One of the biggest scandals in sports history was the 1919 Black Sox scandal, in which eight members of the Chicago White Sox were accused of throwing the World Series in return for payments by a gambling syndicate. Gambling is evil, creates doubt, and destroys your sport, said Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig in 2012. But after the Supreme Court ruling, pro leagues did not want to miss out on the tsunami of money going to private gambling companies and tax money going to states, and now fully embrace sports betting. What form does that take? All the leagues have partnerships with sports books. NHL and MLB players are free to sign endorsement deals with gambling companies, while the NBA allows players' images in sportsbook ads. Sportscasters now regularly discuss betting lines, and last year, TV viewers and radio listeners were barraged with $1.8 billion worth of ads from sportsbooks such as DraftKings, FanDuel, and Caesars, complete with celebrity endorsements. In their ads, sportsbooks offer promotions that are highly effective in roping in first-time bettors. How do those offers work? Sportsbooks offer sign-up bonuses, matches to cash deposits, and risk-free bets that typically refund losing bettors with a credit. These apps are incredibly clever in drawing you in, said Dave Goldsmith, an Arizona solar technician whose wife left him after he lost thousands in online bets. I'll be scrolling through Facebook or Instagram, and an ad will pop up offering promotions or free spins. Sportsbooks generate multiple bets per player by offering a host of ways to bet beyond who'll win or who'll lose the game. There are parlay bets that hinge on the outcome of several different games, with potential jackpot payouts, and micro prop bets such as whether a current football possession will end in a touchdown. Such live betting is like playing a slot machine, said Matt Buchalter, a Toronto actuary who teaches sports betting. A lot of problem gaming behaviors get exacerbated when you're betting every 30 seconds instead of every 3 hours. Not surprisingly, the boom in betting has been followed by a surge in problem gambling. How big a surge? No comprehensive study has been done, but the National Problem Gambling Helpline saw a 45% rise in calls between 2021 and 2022, with an 84% rise in chat messages. In Virginia, helpline calls rose nearly 400% in the first year after legalization. In New Jersey, they tripled between 2018 and 2022. It is disturbing, it is alarming, and it is intensifying every day. Felicia Grondin, executive director of the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, told state lawmakers last year, "For those with a problem, cell phone apps make gambling hard to resist." A 32-year-old Denver mom recently told the Free Press that her family, including her two kids, are on the verge of becoming homeless because of her husband's addiction to sports betting. He'll go for 2 weeks on a gambling binge, lose $15,000, and then stop because he feels guilty, the woman said. Then the process starts all over again. He has slowly depleted literally everything we have. Is anything being done? Advocates for problem gamblers are calling for tighter restrictions on advertising, such as bans on ads during games or on college campuses. Five states have adopted or proposed limits on advertising. Some advocates say gambling operators, who track users' every move on their apps, have a responsibility to identify problem gamblers. With the number of people betting on sports soaring, warned U.S. Representative Paul Tonko, Democrat from New York, there will be growing costs in shattered lives and broken families. This is a public health crisis, Tonko said. And we'll pick up a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. The arrival of alien intelligence. What happens when artificial intelligence becomes far smarter than its creators is the most important question facing humanity, said Stuart Russell. As an AI researcher who began working in the field 45 years ago, I have become alarmed at how fast large language models such as ChatGPT-4 are being adopted across our society with no safety criteria in place. These systems are trained by feeding them tens of trillions of words of text that have not been screened for truth or morality and are not designed or programmed in any meaningful sense. This is why AI chatbots have told users how to commit suicide and build biological weapons, and often provide completely false answers, often supported by fictitious citations. When you ask leading AI researchers whether their systems could develop their own internal goals separate from humanity's, they answer, "We have no idea." Not very reassuring. Should AI's rapid development proceed without oversight or regulation? The arrival of general-purpose superintelligent AI is in many ways analogous to the arrival of a superior alien civilization. The question now facing us is stark. How do we retain power over entities more powerful than us forever? How religion influences politics. One of the most significant shifts in American politics just took place and it barely got any notice, said Ryan Burge. The latest U.S. religion census reveals that from 2010 to 2020, the share of Americans with a religious affiliation dropped by 11 points. This change will ripple across the political landscape, changing how Republicans and Democrats fare in states critical to presidential elections. The God gap is a real phenomenon. Religiously observant people, especially white Christians, are much more likely to vote Republican than those who have a secular worldview, who are much more likely to vote for Democrats. In 2020, Joe Biden got nearly half his votes from non-religious voters. The news from the latest data is mixed for both parties. Religion's influence is not only fading in New England and the Pacific Northwest, but has also sharply declined across Rust Belt states Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That gives Democrats a much better chance of winning those swing states. But religiosity is actually growing in Florida and Texas, likely locking them in as red states. Religion's hold on American society is rapidly changing, and these shifts could decide the 2024 election and future elections as well. This column comes from the Philippines, where you still can't get divorced. It's beyond embarrassing that divorce is still illegal in the Philippines, said Stephen Ku Unjing. Sure, we're a Catholic-majority country with about 80% of us belonging to that faith. Indeed, we have the third-largest population of Catholics in the world, after Brazil and Mexico. But those two countries managed to legalize divorce without their society collapsing into chaos. In fact, being able to choose whether to remain married is uncontroversial everywhere else in the world. Other than Vatican City, whose only residents are priests and nuns, and a revolving regiment of Swiss guards, the Philippines is the only country that still has a divorce ban. Of course, there are exceptions. Muslim Filipinos are allowed to end their marriages at will, and so are any Filipinos married to foreigners. And, of course, the rich have access to the thinly veiled stand-in of legal annulment. For the rest of us, though, the right to divorce is out of reach, and whether we should be given it is the subject of endless political discussion. The debate is emblematic of our great national failing, that we continue to rehash issues that everyone else has long since settled. It's as if, in this age of digital streaming, we are fighting over whether to rent a Betamax or a VHS. And it's time for the last word. Title this week, Deep in a Labyrinth, I Found Myself. An injury mysteriously caused me to lose my sense of direction, said Ingrid Rojas Contreras in the New York Times Magazine. So I decided to visit places where everyone was lost. Who's to say when exactly we started to walk twisting paths, to think of them as sites for enjoyment, for the holy, and for the surreal? Labyrinths and mazes have appeared across culture and time, made by digging ruts into the soil, laying out rocks or mosaic, or enclosing paths within hedges, walls, bamboo, corn, and mirrors. The first recorded labyrinth dates to the 19th century BC, built by Egyptians near the ancient city Arsinoe to hold the sepulcher of kings and crocodiles. Rock-lined labyrinths along the coast of the Baltic Sea may have been created in the Bronze Age. Surviving lore suggests they were used in spring pagan dances and light exorcisms, trapping malevolent spirits in their confounding geometry. And, of course, one of the most enduring myths of ancient Greece is that of the Minotaur lying in wait at the center of the maze. We don't all seek the same things in these winding pathways. People may use the whorls of a labyrinth, unicursal constructions that wind to the center, to enter an exalted spiritual state. Take, for example, the pilgrims who have flocked to the church labyrinth at Chartres Cathedral in France for 1,000 years. Mazes which, unlike labyrinths, fork and multiply and often lead to dead ends, offer a touch more hedonism, drawing tourists from all over for their beauty. The oldest surviving hedge maze, planted in 1690 for King William III in Hampton Court Palace, gets around 330,000 visitors per year. I come to mazes and labyrinths for a different reason. In them, I can be a student of my own bewilderment. Every day since 2007, after an accident and brain injury that gave me temporary amnesia, I have been lost. I am never quite sure where I am. I first realized this cognitive change one day as I was behind the wheel going around the block. Where had I come from? Did I now turn right or left? My husband said we should take me to the doctor. We never did. I can't say why, but somehow it didn't feel like an emergency. Plus, we were both uninsured. Being lost simply became a way of life. I did okay when moving in a straight line, but the second I turned right or left, that mental image tracking my own movements in relationship to my surroundings disappeared. With no point of reference, I journeyed in circles. Is it strange that I enjoyed this? I thought my life was beautiful, ruled as it was by astonishment. It felt like a miracle when I reached my destination. After being lost for 16 years, a day came when I craved being lost on purpose. I fantasized about meandering in some of the world's most ancient mazes in search of designs meant to invent and enhance my confusion, where I could finally escape the pressure to find and be found. Outside the castle of Chenonceau in Chenonceau, France, is one of the most dazzling mazes in Europe. Of course, I lose my way getting there. At the train station in Paris, a tall man calls out to inform me that I am looking at arrivals and not departures. Luckily, we are going to the same train. Diane de Poitiers lived in the castle, as did Catherine de Medici. The castle is built over the water, part of it atop a bridge that spans the river Cher. Ample gardens, designed first by the Poitiers and then Medici, featured box hedges, diagonal paths, flower beds, urns, fountains, and yew trees. The maze is a bit away from the property, built centuries after de Medici's death. As I follow the signs through warming sunlight and a trilling forest, I am dumbstruck. 2,000 yew trees make up its winding paths. The ground crunches underfoot, and I make my first choice between two paths. The tops of the hedges are razor sharp and curved this way and that, fitting into one another like a puzzle. They are up to my chin. At the center, I can see the elevated wooden platform of a gloriette. I turn around and the path splits into four. I have been here before. I am a child of the 90s, raised on Jim Henson's Labyrinth. So dutifully, I make a mark on the ground. I walk through jolts of light, and somehow when I look up, I have made it to the middle. Impressive. From the raised platform, I see four caryatids directly across the maze from the winged lion statues guarding its entrance. I think I am advancing in a way that will lead out, but instead I arrive, over and over again, at the gloriette. Navigating spaces is a voyage at sea. A friendly ship appears. Vous avez besoin d'aide? A woman calls. Non, merci, I call back. Ah, merde. Suddenly, I think I see where the hedges part. where the woman is now joyously excited. I hurry in a line to the spot. When I exit, I double over, hooting beneath the caryatids, which I now see are pockmarked with time, faces and hands missing. But I smile up at the one white giant, holding a club, wearing what looks like a cloak with a lion head attached. A different sort of maze exists underneath the city of Paris. Most of it is closed to the public, but that doesn't stop lovers of labyrinthine from sneaking in. I met Leo Cavernicole there, 65 feet below ground in the Parisian catacombs. She is a cataphile, an urban explorer entranced by the secret catacombs, a network of subterranean ancient stone quarries, tunnels, and galleries that sprawl for more than 170 miles in a sort of negative of the city above. The catacombs were born in the 18th century when some of the abandoned limestone quarries began to weaken and parts of the city caved in. Overflowing cemeteries meant the bones of Parisians, some of them 1,200 years old, had to be relocated. There are only a few areas of the catacombs accessible to the public. Among them is the ossuary, where 6 million Parisians find their resting place. The entrance is in Montparnasse, 131 steps down a spiral staircase. At each revolution, the sound of the city recedes. Leo is just a nickname. Cataphiles never use their real names, Leo tells me. Venturing into the secret catacombs is illegal, and cataphiles are always hiding from Cataflic, catacomb police. The map that most Parisian cataphiles build on goes back to World War II, when the doctors Jean Tellerac and René Sattel made a drawing of the underground tunnels beneath Paris to give to the French resistance. Using what he learned from mapping the catacombs, Tellerac, a neurosurgeon, would one day begin the work of mapping the brain. No one can actually get permanently lost in the ossuary because, as you make your way by walls of bones arranged many years ago by quarrymen in the shape of a cross, crosses, hearts, and once upon a time a miniature Eiffel Tower, the circuitous paths have been blocked, so there is only one way forward. But before the ossuary was altered, someone did get lost. Philibert Aspert entered the catacombs in 1793 and wasn't found until 11 years later, his tomb in the quarry gallery where he took his last breath. In the ossuary on the roof of the tunnel, there is a black line painted on the ceiling so modern-day guides can ferry curious Parisians in and out of this wet underworld. It reminds me of the red thread Ariadne gave to Theseus when he entered the maze to fight the Minotaur. The corridor winds, and I come across stone placards that bear the names of the streets above, some of which don't exist anymore. It is a delight to be unmoored from the world. Leo and the cataphiles understand this too. It is midnight when I land in Barcelona, and if you can believe it, I lose my way in the airport. The immigration officers are annoyed with me and, instead of escorting me, give me verbal directions to a hidden stairway. I look behind every column as if the secret stairs I am looking for might be the mouse size or hidden behind trapdoors. Finally, I see a janitor. She says she will take me to the secret stairs. Making my slow way to Parc de Labyrinthe de Horta the next morning, I start to wonder if I might be allergic to actually trying to get anywhere. I know the maze is somewhere, and I have all day. The maze I am here to see was built in 1791, designed by the Italian architect Domenico Baguti. The park feels like a beautiful secret ruin. A stone swan spouts water in a fountain, and I follow a cement spiral staircase down to a tiered cascade. Unlike at Chenonceau, The maze here is full of visitors. Over the cypress hedges, which are about 7 feet tall, I hear, "This way," and "We've been here before," and "God help you if we stay the night." A curved wall frames the entrance to this maze, Ariadne giving Theseus the famed ball of red thread in bas relief. I am not prepared for how emotional I will feel. I am watching strangers try one way and then in seconds return cackling, telling me, "It's not that way. Take it from us." I grow teary and happy. Everyone is lost. I am maze roving as children run past me. I pick away and notice a couple are following me. I lead us to a dead end. I want to tell them they've picked the wrong leader, but I don't. Instead, I smile and say, "Your turn." More dead ends. Onlookers yell down from a balcony, telling people which way they are supposed to turn. It is also riotous. I am falling in love with everyone. I am walking in circles, and I run into the same couples again and again. I see the first couple who followed me, and this time I follow them. They tell me they think they know where the center is. We veer left, and then into a clearing. The hedges here grow tall and curve in, kissing in an arch. At the center of it all is not a minotaur, but a statue of beautiful Eros, with curled marbled hair and a cloth over his groin. Eros' left arm is severed, but his right leans on a log, and a satchel of arrows hangs at his back. I watch a pigeon land on Eros' head, and everything seems idyllic. Next to me on the bench is Oscar, a librarian. He says he used to come to the maze as a child and then as a teenager. With friends, he would hide, waiting until the park closed. By moonlight, they would trespass into the maze, carrying bottles of wine. He pauses to call out to his son, who is running with other children along the paths of the maze. In the middle, there are 8 possible paths, each framed by a high hedge arch. Oscar and I weigh our options. A man in fleece enters the clearing from one of the archways, talking to a woman. "There is no way out. We have tried all the ways." Oscar straightens, deciding to try. He invites me to join, but I decline, wanting to dwell a bit longer at the center. I watch Oscar leave and think about what it is I love so much about being lost. It's not the puzzle that interests me, but how the bright confusion I feel is besieged by a wonder that multiplies. Here in the middle, at the revolving door of leave takings and arrivals, I find a community of the lost. When I get up to try the paths, I half jokingly tell a woman, red-lipped and blonde, that I am using her as a marker and beg her not to move. She laughs at me each time I return, pointing the way to the next path I am supposed to follow. Indeed, it is the last path I try that begins to lead out. I can tell it's the right way by the sheer excitement of everyone around me, the voices not too far gasping in delight that mean I will soon be out. I have been 3 wondrous hours lost. I walk slower, looking up at the hedges, grieving, laughing. Walking anywhere is a leap of faith, and arriving when faith returns. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. One of the obituaries this week. The voice of calm in the Iran hostage crisis. Harding Carter III, 1935 to 2023. Only once did Harding Carter III lose his cool with the press. a Mississippi journalist who championed civil rights and spoke with a Southern drawl. He was the Carter administration's Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs when the Iranian hostage crisis began in November 1979. He masterfully answered or evaded difficult questions during the many months that 52 Americans spent as hostages in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. But one day, annoyed by persistent questions from one reporter during a press conference, he threw a rubber chicken at him. "The briefing is a form of ritualized combat," Carter said in 1980. "I like the give and take." Progressive politics ran in his family, said Politico. William Hodding Carter III was the oldest child of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hodding Carter Jr., a crusading newsman. He grew up in Greenville, Mississippi, where his father had founded the Delta Star newspaper. After graduating from Princeton University in 1957 and spending 2 years in the Marine Corps, Carter returned to Greenville as a reporter for the paper, now called the Greenville Delta Democrat Times. He stayed for 17 years, following his father as editor and publisher and pushing an anti-segregationist line, particularly after the murder of three civil rights workers in 1964, shone a national spotlight on race relations in Mississippi. He left to work on the 1976 presidential campaign of Jimmy Carter, no relation, a fellow white liberal from the South, said the Washington Post. After he helped deliver Mississippi's electoral votes, President Carter appointed him to the State Department. Carter resigned that post after the failure of a military attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran, said the New York Times. He returned to journalism and became a prominent television political commentator, correspondent, analyst, and anchor, doing a four-year stint at PBS's Inside Story and winning multiple Emmys. In 2006, he turned to teaching, lecturing in public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He remained committed to upholding his father's legacy of progressive Southern journalism. "I never knew a time when he wasn't afraid of the consequences of what he was writing and doing," Carter said in 1981. "I learned from my father what courage was really about. It was being afraid, but doing what you had to do." And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. We have an article titled, "The Pandemic: What We Did Right and What We Did Wrong." "Ready or not, it's over," said Melissa Healy in the Los Angeles Times. The federal government's three-year-old pandemic state of emergency expired last week. Although the still-evolving virus has killed 1.1 million-plus Americans, and by the end of 2023 will have cost the U.S. economy a staggering $14 trillion. Early this month, COVID continued to exact a weekly toll of some 77,000 infections and 1,000 deaths. Still, prior infections, vaccination, or both, have now given nearly all Americans some level of immunity, and new variants have evolved to become more infectious but less lethal. As COVID lost two-thirds of its initial killing power, COVID deaths dropped by 47% between 2021 and 2022. For the past year, the overwhelming majority of deaths have occurred among people over 75. Regional and racial disparities remain, with Southerners, African Americans, and Native Americans experiencing higher death rates. Long COVID symptoms continue to haunt millions of people, but for most Americans, the pandemic feels over. In a recent poll, only 11% rated COVID as a severe threat. But COVID itself is here to stay, and 1,200 days after its shocking arrival changed everyone's lives, we're still living with the social, economic, and political fallout of the worst pandemic in a century. "Our country's response, while flawed, got several things right," said Janine Interlandi in the New York Times. "Stimulus checks and other safety net measures kept millions fed and housed even after they lost their jobs. Despite noisy and occasionally violent protest, A silent majority of citizens donned masks and obeyed social distancing edicts, slowing the spread of infection and death. We also underwent a unique experiment in universal health care, said Dylan Scott in Vox. Americans received free COVID tests, free vaccines, and free COVID antiviral drugs. But now much of that free care is being phased out. And the end of continuing Medicaid coverage during the emergency phase means an estimated 15 million low-income people will be purged from the rolls. Public trust was among the pandemic's casualties, said Jay Evanson in Deseret News. Before vaccines were available, it was reasonable for health officials to tell the public there were plenty of reasons to be afraid. But as bioethicist Ezekiel J. Emanuel and 33 other medical and policy experts argue in their new book, Lessons from the COVID War, mixed messages on face masks and the persistence of harsh government controls eroded the public's patience. Schools remained closed longer than those of many other countries, leading to learning loss and behavioral problems. Painful trade-offs were inevitable, but our public health leaders should have anticipated that many Americans would grow weary of prioritizing COVID over everything else. Anthony Fauci and other public health officials have since done some public soul-searching, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. Not so for conservatives, even though they got COVID extremely wrong. As COVID ravaged the nation in 2020, then-President Trump repeatedly claimed that the virus would go away, and right-wing think tanks in the Wall Street Journal predicted that the death toll would not surpass 500, then 5,000, then 40,000. Both Trump and Vice President Mike Pence continued calling for a quick reopening, even as the desperately sick filled hospitals and bodies stacked up at overwhelmed morgues. Trump touted quack cures such as hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, while Florida Governor Ron DeSantis turned anti-vaxxer beliefs into state policy. Since then, the right's anti-science hostility has only grown. Operation Warp Speed, which produced an effective vaccine at the fastest pace in history and saved millions of lives, now constitutes a political liability for Republicans, and even Trump is running away from it. Believe it or not, we were dealt a lucky hand this time, said immunologist Kizmikia Corbey in The Time. Earlier SARS-1 and MERS outbreaks gave those of us who worked on coronaviruses a head start on COVID vaccine research. Had such an infectious disease emerged from one of the other 23 viral families, it might have taken our team at the National Institutes of Health 600 days, not 66, to produce a trial-ready vaccine. The Biden administration warned of a 20% chance of another mass infection event within 2 years, has invested $5 billion into Project NextGen to develop new COVID vaccines and therapies, including a nasal vaccine and a possible pan-coronavirus shot that would protect against all future variants. But we need a more proactive approach to infectious diseases, a broader understanding of how they jump from animals to humans and spread so we can stop them early. Other pandemics undoubtedly lie ahead. If we choose inaction, we're doomed to repeat our mistakes. And a few of the short notes here. Between 20 and 2022, states with Republican-controlled legislatures had about a 50% higher rate of deaths from firearms assaults than states with Democratic-controlled legislatures. They had about a 35% higher rate of mass killings. 10 Democrat-majority states have laws banning assault weapons, including 3 approved over the past year in Illinois, Delaware, and Washington State. As a result of mass shootings, This is now an electorally winning issue, said Washington Governor Jay Inslee. The number of people around the globe displaced by conflict or natural disasters reached a record high of 71.1 million in 2022. More than 12 million people were displaced by the wars in Ukraine and Syria, while the total displaced by disasters such as floods and famine was 8.7 million, up 42% from 2021, according to the Norwegian Refugee Council. The amount of wealth held by families in the U.S. more than tripled from about $38 trillion, adjusted for inflation, in 1989 to $140 trillion last year. A projected $84 trillion of that money will be passed down from baby boomers and other old Americans to millennial and Gen X heirs over the coming two decades. And we've got time for two quotes. We'll start with one from economist Herbert Simon, who says, "A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention." And from Maya Angelou, who says, "A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.